today and help our dreams grow.
Hello, New York. It's me, Jimmy Dore, and I'm back on New York's alternative radio station, WBAI. Tune in to the Jimmy Dore Show every Thursday night at midnight into Friday morning on WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM in New York and streaming online worldwide at WBAI.org.
And that's where your dial is set, 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York, 9 p.m. Time now for Backstage Stories with Marcia Pendleton.
And welcome to Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I am Marcia Pendleton, the producer and your host. Our guest has worked nearly 50 years in such theater, television, and film projects as The American President, The West Wing, Star Trek, and Network on Broadway. He is one of the most revered character actors in the business. You may not know his name, but you definitely know his face. We're here with Ron Canada, actor, director, producer, and I want to say welcome to Backstage Stories.
Thank you, Marcia. Happy to be here.
Let's get into your origin story. I read that you were born in Manhattan and raised in Harlem, you know, so you're a native New Yorker.
Absolutely.
And a Harlemite. As someone who is not from New York, I know that everybody that I have met from Harlem has this swag, you know, like this swagger. to them. So before we start talking about the project that you're working on now, Pay the Writer, let's talk about being raised in Harlem and what it was like growing up there. And what was it like? How did it affect your worldview, I guess I want to say? Growing up in what is considered to be the mecca of Black culture?
Well, I grew up in Harlem in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And my parents weren't part of the middle class. My parents were blue collar working folk. Neither of my parents had a high school diploma. Lived on what is now Frederick Douglass at about 131st Street when I was a little boy in a four-story, what was there then, at 2421 8th Avenue, as it was called, a four-story apartment building, you know. Mm-hmm. Built, I guess, around the turn of the century somewhere. I walk up and in 1954, we moved across the street to the then brand new St. Nicholas Projects. For anybody who knows Harlem, they're the housing projects, the NYCHA projects, that are two blocks north of the Apollo. The building that we moved into and where I lived until I was 12 was, you could walk out, if you could walk directly through the intervening blocks, it is in directly in line with the backstage door of the Apollo. It was a project full of aspiring, but, you know, low income folk. You know, we're just living our lives in the struggle of Black people in urban America in the 50s. And I had no perspective on anything else because that was my world in and around 125th Street. Mm-hmm. I can remember being a boy going past the Teresa Hotel, which I knew was something big and very important. That's where all the Black celebrities stayed when they were visiting Harlem. Of course, being around the corner from the Apollo, I can remember occasionally me and my sister going there when they had low priced afternoon shows for the kids and seeing, you know, James Brown and the Isley Brothers there. Starting to be interested in movies, seeing the double features on the weekends at the RKO Alhambra Theater, which was around the corner from my house. So I can remember walking down to dentist and doctor's appointment and always looking out as I went past Sugar Ray Robinson's lounge mm-hmm. to see if I saw one of his, you know, big purple or pink or bright yellow Cadillacs and hoping to get a glimpse of him. It was not that I didn't have any consciousness of, the mecca of Black life because, my parents were busy working and surviving. They didn't know, you know, about Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, those kind of, because they were people who were from the Southern diaspora who came out of the Jim Crow South so they could get a chance to work. And they weren't part of the what people I think view as the glamorous Harlem life, which was for middle class folk, and we weren't the middle. Mm-hmm, we were the bottom. Mm-hmm. It was rough, to tell you the truth. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I've literally, when I was a boy going to school at St. Nicholas Avenue and 127th Street, the school is now an apartment building. Anybody who knows the area knows between 126th and 127th, there's a big gray apartment building. It was converted from my elementary school. And in the two blocks between the project and the school, that's when I saw, you know, I would have to literally weave my way around heroin addicts and what we called then, as we referred to them then, winos, people, unfortunate alcoholic people, in the couple of blocks intervening between school and home. And I learned to, you know, I saw these things it wasn't the glamorous Sugar Hill life. That right. was, mm-hmm. Those were people up on St. Nicholas Terrace and of the cliff above, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. to the west. And, that was another life for other people, jazz musicians and poets and so forth. I had no consciousness of them being there. And I'm being candid, being honest. I'm not going to, I've come to realize that for people who didn't grow up there, they are, of course, enthralled with all of the great minds and talents that were there. But, you know, this is America and there are class levels. And mm-hmm. That was for another class of folk, to be mm-hmm. perfectly candid. With everything that's happened to me and as far as my parents' labors have allowed me and my sister and my sister's children to go beyond their status in the world, their level of experience, their breadth of experience, I've come to appreciate some of those things. But the Harlem I grew it, up in was, it was an insular village in many ways, and it was rough. Like anybody growing up in the lower class of America, of any race and ethnic background in any urban setting, it was that. And those experiences aren't that different, whether West Coast, East Coast, whether it's Oakland or Cleveland or Philadelphia or Baltimore. I know that, that world.
How did you become conscious of, not necessarily of what was happening artistically and culturally in Harlem, but how did the art become a part of your life?
Well, here's the interesting anomalous thing about the description I was just giving. In public education at that time, public school, I grew up in the New York of Governors Averell Harriman and more particularly Nelson Rockefeller. And there was this kind of noblesse oblige kind of thing that when you are a New York City public school kid, even in dead center middle of Harlem, you got exposed to things like museums and plays and operas and ballets, because they take the whole school, put them on the subway, take us to MoMA. I tell people I've actually seen with my own eyes Picasso's Guernica when it was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Yeah, I saw it in 1959, 1960. I didn't know the full magnitude of it, but I remember them taking into the room where it was and a hush falling over us children. Mm. You know, I remember that. I remember trips that where we went to the Natural History Museum and the Planetarium. And when I think I saw, I can remember seeing Madame Butterfly on a school trip in 1960. These kinds of things were part of the cultural enrichment of public education in the 50s in New York. And anybody of a certain age, I'm 74 right now, anybody who grew up in that time will I think, you know, support what I'm saying and verify what I'm saying. I get the feeling I'm a long way from public school, you know,
we both are.
Fours or more, but I get the feeling that a lot of that
is gone.
Kind of enhancement is gone and drifted away. But by the time I was in the seventh grade or anywhere in the city, particularly though in Manhattan, by the time I got to be 13, I had seen an opera. I had seen a Shakespeare performance. I had seen a play. I knew what the big museums were in New York. I'd seen these things. And you know, you don't have perspective. You're just a kid. We're going on a school trip. Yay. We don't have to be in class all day. And I had a wonderful teacher, at PS 157. His name was Frederick Ford, and he was the best teacher in the school. We were tracked. There was something called a track system in schools that back then, and I think it's fallen into ill repute. But classes were ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 with numbers. 4-1. That meant that you were among the kids who were considered to have the most quote unquote potential of 4-2, 4-3, 4-4. And Frederick Ford taught the me in fifth grade and sixth grade, and he introduced me to County Cullen and Claude McKay. We would get up, he would ask who wants to get up and read for the class today, you know, Claude McKay's If I Must Die, or County Cullen, What Is Africa to Me? something, something cinema tree. Anyway, I would raise my hand. I was always ready to get up in front of the class and read from the book, read aloud. And he used to play for us on Fridays. If we were good, he would put on, because he wanted to, I think, catch up on his grading of papers and his paperwork. If we were good, we would get to listen to Carmen, the opera. He would put on this big 33 records, or he would put on The King and I, or he had a set of different records that he would play on Friday afternoons. And of course, it piqued your interest. It opened up our world, mm-hmm. our world aside from, you know, the three or four blocks all around us. It let us know all of these kinds of experiences in public school education. As I say, I went to ghetto school, and I found out later that I learned a lot of things that a lot of people in other places didn't get exposed to. So that's what it was. And I'm talking about Harlem, 1955 to 63, you know, mm-hmm. when I was a boy. And of course we do all the bad boy things that you're not supposed to do, get into rock fights and sneak up on roofs above 7th Avenue and throw water balloons down on cars and do all those wicked little, you know, walk all the way over to Grant's Tomb and then down to the West Side Highway. I look at it now, and I remember crossing that highway as boys, you know, in 9, 10 years old, so we could get down by the river and skip rocks in the river. You know, that was a big, long day trip from the project. So these are the things that I remember. But, you know, that was... Harlem was not monolithic, is my point.
And, right, absolutely. I do understand.
So that was just my slice of experience. You know, my viewpoint. But that's all of those things, those exposures, just excited me and exhilarated me. And I was already a voracious reader. Both of mm-hmm. my parents, though, they had my mom stopped school in the 9th grade. My father stopped in 7th grade. I can always remember them reading, mm-hmm. reading the newspaper, books and magazines. We always had my mother. We couldn't wait. She had subscriptions to Look and Life and Ebony. And as soon as she was through with them, she would hand them over to us. And I would just pore over page after page. People don't know what those kinds of magazines were with spectacular photography. Black and white, and then later in color, but it again opening up the world. And we didn't have video games and all of those kinds of things, and TVs were small screens and big pieces of furniture that you had to be fiddling the rabbit ears and all of that. But the reading, always encouraged to read, always seeing my parents reading in the house, always. You know, aware of newspapers. And I think in New York at that time, we had many more daily newspapers mm-hmm. aside from the News, the Post, the Times, the there was the Journal American and the Daily Mirror, and, you know, Herald Tribune. I remember all those papers because I saw them, and one or the other of them was always in my house. So anyway, long-winded answer. No.
That's okay. That's okay. I found out that...
And the Amsterdam News.
And also. The Amsterdam News.
Yeah.
That reading is a window to the world. It is a window to the world. And I, like a lot of other people of our generation, had Look and Life and Ebony and Jet in the house. Yeah. I learned everything about Broadway living in Philadelphia, reading mm-hmm. Ebony magazine, because at that point in time, they would put Broadway stars on the cover of Ebony Magazine, and that's how I learned about it. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was theater, and I knew it was fabulous, and I knew I wanted to be a part of it.
Marcia, the economics of theater were different because I remember my mother and her girlfriend occasionally would go on Wednesdays. They were so expensive that these ladies from Harlem could go downtown and sit in the upper seats and see Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. She never took me with her, but I know she would. She and her closest female friends would get dressed up on a Wednesday afternoon, and they would go down and see a show. Yeah, I was aware that it was there. I didn't, mm-hmm. And I would see the ads for Broadway shows in the newspaper, and it was all mysterious to me. But I can remember seeing ads for King and I and Gigi and See How They Run and various other plays. Then I remember maybe it was 1961. It seems like the early 60s. It's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But I can remember finally seeing Raisin in the Sun at the movie theater and just being completely blown away, flabbergasted by Sidney Poitier.
Did you know that you wanted to be an actor when you saw Mr. Poitier do that, or did that come much later?
It came later, but I knew he was an electrifying presence. It is hard to express and make get across to young people what a exhilarating presence he was. He because the other black men, particularly black male actors that you saw at that time, were always they were talented people doing what they had to do with the opportunities available to them, being kind of playing subservient roles or kind of clown roles, and I remember feeling vaguely embarrassed, and then I saw Mr. Poitier and his ramrod straight back and his open-eyed stare right into the eyes of white people and his head high and the dignity of his voice and the gravitas of his presence. And he was electrifying.
He was majestic.
And I think any actor, any of us who've had the fortune to have some success in his career in and around my age, I think my contemporaries like Joe Morton, mm-hmm. Sam Jackson, and mm-hmm. Denzel Bing, and they would all echo something similar. He was the man, and and no doubt about it, he is the OG of OGs for us.
For sure. I wanted to speak with you about you being a journalist. You are an award-winning journalist, which came before the full-time acting career.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, I was, it was the late 60s, and I got a job at NBC at 30 Rock because they, the late, great Clifford Alexander, a historical presence, especially around in New York and in this area. He had been Secretary of the Army, I think under Johnson, and he kind of was the first guy to push affirmative action. I don't know what exact government position he had or whether he had just moved on. He had a TV show on the weekend, but he was a political force, Clifford Alexander. And he was bringing focus on the fact that these networks, NBC and CBS and ABC, didn't have any very few minority employees. And the entry-level positions to get into the company were these positions, tour guide positions. And so they were, I got wind of the fact that they were looking for candidates to enter into this entry program at NBC. And I started out taking people on tours of 30 Rockefeller Plaza to make the compress the story. And that led to a job within the company with elsewhere in the building in 30 Rock, a small, very low junior kind of the junior most possessor of an executive bathroom key up in the tower of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, and doing, you know, bureaucratic network work. And then the NBC News and ABC and CBS had realized after the riots in various parts of the country in the late 60s that they didn't have reporters who could go into minority communities and report and talk to people and interview people and be comfortable in that environment to go in and do broadcast journalism. So they created a program which was at Columbia and with the cooperation of the networks. And I was admitted to that program. And as a result of that program, I got a job in Baltimore at the NBC affiliate in Baltimore. And Channel 11 in 1971. And that's how I started my broadcast news career. A few years later, I moved slightly south, 38 miles to Washington, D.C., and became the City Hall correspondent, the district correspondent, as we called it, at City Hall in Washington, where I covered Marion Barry when he was city councilman in the first home rule government in Washington, D.C. You went to school in the area, so you're familiar mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. The people of D.C. had just gotten the right to have their own municipal government, called the home rule government. Of the previously, the people of D.C. had been the government governed by Congress without any direct control, not any direct right to vote for their own city councilmen and mayors and so forth to run their own city. And it was the birth of home rule, and I arrived in D.C. right about the same time and became a City Hall reporter. And that's what I did until I found my bliss, as they say, and moved on to theater and to film and television, entertainment television.
How did you find that bliss, or how did it find you?
Well, you know, television news is a very intense, very competitive business, and everybody in television news gets fired at some point or another. And so I won an Emmy one day in 1977. They told me I won the Emmy in September and October, the local Emmy in D.C. Then 36 hours later, they let me go. So that will cause one to pause. And I was 28 and kind of burned out on the news and was asking, like a lot of people we get to do in America in our late 20s, well, you know, now I'm sort of a grown up. What is it that I want to do? What do I have a desire to try? And being the New York boy and having the exposure to theater and film that you get in New York as a beyond what I was talking about before as a teenager and a young adult, a college student at City College in New York, I had always had this feeling when I watch performances that in film or on stage that I understood what they were doing up there. And it was always clear to me in a way that didn't seem to occurred to my friends and companions who would go to see these shows. I always seem to have more, a little bit more insight into what we were watching. And it, I wanted to try it. I wanted to see what it was to view the world from that side of the screen, from that side of the stage. And as soon as I tried it, it was like waking up from a long nap. It was the becoming an actor was, it seemed, it's going to sound strange, it felt more at the beginning like recalling something that I had known rather than learning something completely new. It seemed like a remembering of some sort. But anyway, it fit me like a glove. I found joy at work that I had never found. Journalism is delivering, look, the news is bad. Basically, the fodder of journalism is bad things being done to people by other people, bad, disappointing, and often terrible things. And it often, the news serves to make people feel beyond informed. It can be depressing. It can make people feel anxious, powerless. It can fill people with a fear of the world, like the exaggerated fear of crime in New York City that was used by certain candidates, in the last election. Well, if you watch the television news, you think that the Visigoths are running up and down the street.
Yes.
You have a city of 8.85 million people. There's going to be a crime here or there. But as we know, statistically, this is like the safest city in America. We
absolutely
have more police than anybody by far. Mm-hmm. We have 35, 40,000 police. So in a city of almost 9 million people, you're going to find a horrific incident every day. If you focus on it and focus on it all the time, people think, oh my God, we're not safe. Well, I got tired of being in the fear business. Mm-hmm. I realized that what I was selling to people, what they were selling with the commercials, in between the commercials, which is the most important thing in television to the people who run television, was selling fear. And after 6 years of that, I was much more inclined to try to bring some joy and some hope into people's lives. And when you want to be in the joy and hope and insight business, in the you are not alone business, then, the business of putting on the drama and the comedy is a good place to be. And once I landed there, I had the appreciation of living in the land of darkness every day for 6 years. And so I was happy to come into the business of hope and light and creating some understanding between human beings.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host. Ron Canada will star in Pay the Writer, a new play by Tawny O'Dell, directed by Karen Carpenter. Pay the Writer begins a 7-week off-Broadway engagement at Signature Center on August 13th. For details, visit paythewriterplay.com. That's paythewriterplay.com. And we're back with Ron Canada, and we are going to talk about his latest project, Pay the Writer. What is this play about? What is this play about, and who wrote it?
It was written by Tawny O'Dell, who is a novelist that was kind of discovered and put on national stage by Oprah. She won one Oprah Book Award, which, when the Queen puts her blessing on something, wow, it rockets it's to the done. Top. And so Tawny will tell you in a minute, Oprah opened up everything for me. But Tony Odell wrote the play. It's a play about a fictional great novelist, which is the role I play, a writer named Cyrus Holt, who has come to a critical point in his life. He has been recognized and celebrated. He's won a Pulitzer Prize, all kinds, every kind of literary award. He is somebody who we're led to believe is on a stature with people like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin. And he's fictional, of course. Norman Mailer. He's on that level of literary. He's recognized around the world as a genius. But he is a complex and deeply flawed man. And as happens with so many public figures, people in their private lives pay a price, a high emotional price for all of that fame. I just recently watched a documentary about the great boxer of the 90s and 80s, Oscar De La Hoya. Mm-hmm. And it's very revelatory of him being the golden boy in public and being a disaster for his family mm-hmm. in private. And so Cyrus Holt, without giving away too much of the story, has a similar history to that. And he has been given the license that a lot of great artists are to have outsized appetites. Mm-hmm. So he's come to a point in his life where the consequences of all that are in front of him, and he has to come to grips with what he has done in his relationships. And one of the key relationships is with his agent, his literary agent, who has shepherded his career through the last 35, 40 years, and his ex-wife and his two children. And it's basically about his translator in who translates his novels into French. He's kind of a Francophile, as many great American artists have been, you know, as was Baldwin, as was Josephine Baker, mm-hmm. where, you know, often we African Americans, you know, discover that outside of the country, we're viewed somewhat differently, mm-hmm. Accepted for our abilities and not for some need of people to feel superior to us. So Cyrus has had that happen to him. And it's about him coming to grips with the consequences of a lifetime of actions on his part, and how he does or does not resolve those issues with the people closest to him. I think, without giving anything away, that's kind of a summary of the story.
So before we began the formal part of our conversation, you began to talk about what is important in terms of you taking on work. What do you say yes to, and in what ways does Pay the Writer fit that saying yes part?
The first and foremost, Marcia, now for me at this, I've been doing this for almost 50 years, and I'm a septuagenarian, as I stated before. It's story. Actors, writers, we're basically storytellers. Every society on this planet has gathered around the fire and listened to the storytellers. And stories can amuse us. Stories can deepen our understanding of ourselves and each other. But a good story can just take our minds to another place and stimulate our imaginations and just make time literally fly. Mm-hmm. You know, a good story is always over too soon. So that's what I look for in material. I'm fortunate enough at this point in life not to have to work. I work on what I choose to work on. And I'm deeply grateful. I say that not with braggadocio, but with a profound gratitude, because not every artist gets to be in that position. And it's a combination of ability, but it's also a combination of fortune and having good people around you. But I'm in that situation. And at 74, you don't want to waste any days doing things that are not of value. I say to, when I'm even coaching or directing, I say our job is to tell stories, but they're to tell stories that uplift the people, meaning all the people, and increase the peace. That's my objective. Lift the people and increase the peace. And that doesn't mean sugarcoating everything. Sometimes to increase the peace, we have to examine conflict on all levels. So I'm looking for that when I'm reading a piece of material. I'm looking for things that adhere to my values, that enhance human dignity and human freedom. A great teacher of acting, Michael Chekhov, says that even when we perform and show, act ugliness, we must act it beautifully. Mm. You know, so, you know, if a great musician, or let's say Winston Marsalis, plays a discordant piece that is conceived that way, it may make us uncomfortable, even in the listening, in the jagged, but I rest assured he is playing it technically beautifully. Mm-hmm. But that's, I kind of got sidetracked there. But the point is, okay. The point is that when I find a piece of material that adheres to my value, that is not trashing the human mind or the human spirit or dehumanizing people or, you know, cheapening human life and human aspiration. When I find that piece of material, okay, this is a doggone good story. It's worth telling. I want to be a part of telling it. But then when you get a character like Cyrus Holt, who is at once recognizable and a total stranger, and you feel that little fear when you think about playing it, when it makes me say, gosh, I don't know if I could achieve that. I could fail trying to play this person. That's when you've got to do it.
Okay.
That's when, as an artist, you have to do it. And I found such a character in Cyrus Holt. He's some places a twin to me, and in other places, the worst in parts of myself. And there are places that are just Cyrus. And he's a character of magnitude, of size. And I've gotten to play some big, pretty big characters. Mm-hmm. Troy Maxson and Fences and, you know, Macbeth, Iago, Othello. To me, Cyrus is potentially of that size. And if he's not, then to the degree that he's not, it seems to me that that will be my shortcoming. But he's certainly worthy piece of a blueprint on which to construct, and a challenging one, and one that has risk. And the risk always, as an artist, is the risk that you will fail, and you will fail publicly. And that's what, strangely enough, makes you want to try.
Okay. So you alluded to this a few sentences back about what you have in common with Cyrus and what you do not. Can you expand on that? Can you tell us what the what is?
Well, the things we're getting overly self-confessional here. When I was a young man, I was a man of, let's say, hedonistic appetite.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say great appetites.
Yeah, and so I identified with that part of him. I recognized that. I also knew that books and letters and words had set him free as a poor, a working class, lower working class young black man whose father had been a coal miner. My father was a longshoreman here on the west side of Manhattan. Longshoreman like the famous Brando movie, title doesn't come to me now, On the Waterfront.
On the Waterfront.
On the Waterfront, you know, that was my father's life in and around New York Harbor. And what had lifted Cyrus from there to being a world figure was books, reading, writing, letters, the word. The word had unlocked the world for him. And once the door was open, he shouldered his way through. And in that, we were parallel. You know, like I said, I'm a poor boy from the low-income projects right off 125th Street. Okay, the NYCHA houses. And now my face is known, you know, around the world. I'm not a star, but, you know, enough so that when I was in Paris last winter, you know, people turned and looked, and some people said, you know, you're Ron Canada. You know, there's a Wikipedia page. You know, I got there from where I started to here, two successful careers in American media, all due to the word, command and relish of the English language. Reading it voraciously, learning to write it competently, being able to put it in my mouth so no one could mistake my meaning. That has been my vehicle to everything. And to being able to say I work when I want to work and not when anybody else wants me to. And that commonality and brotherhood I have with Cyrus. He can be, as I was when I was younger, a bit of a volatile personality. In the news business, they once wrote that I had two chips on my shoulders. Not one chip, but two chips. So Cyrus, his blood runs a little hot, as mine has a great deal of my life. So in all those ways, we, and some others that, are, you know, I'd rather keep to myself, we are.
On public radio.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I recognize him on every page. I recognize him. And as I work on him, I just know where he's coming from, like no other character that I've ever played. And that's a challenge also, to make sure you're serving the character and doing your work when the character in so many ways fits like a tailored suit.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I am Marcia Pendleton, your host. Please check out Ron Canada and his co-stars, Marsha Cross of Desperate Housewives fame, and Brian Batt, best known for his work on TV's Mad Men, in Pay the Writer. Ron told me that Marsha and Brian are the real deal. And when a company comes together as an ensemble, that's when the real fun begins. Pay the Writer begins off-Broadway on August 13th. For details, visit paythewriterplay.com. That's paythewriterplay.com. And we're back with Ron Canada. I'd like to ask you, what's next? Anything that you can talk about?
I you know, it's funny. People often think that when you reach a certain stature in this business that you know you have your projects lined up. And there are people that do. They're called stars. I'm sure Denzel knows what he's going to be doing, and Samuel L. knows what they're going to be doing, and my colleague from the Broadway Play Network, Bryan Cranston, he's going to take a vacation, but you know they would be lined up. Me, I have no idea. I'm still at the level where from time to time people want me to audition to see if I'm capable of doing whatever character it is that they have in mind. I'm not that kind of household name. And for the vast majority of actors, that's the way we live. I only audition if I want to, but there, it's not like people are saying, we want Ron for this, we want Ron for that. I didn't know, but whatever the next role is, I have a saying, it's moving toward me. It's under the water. I don't see it. And it'll be a while before I see even the tip of the dorsal fin on its back, but it's moving toward me. And when it comes, you know, I'll take it on. I had no idea of the existence of Cyrus Holt or Bay the Writer 60 days ago. No idea. I'm in a category of actors that time has decreased the number of us, the guys that I've had the honor of competing with for the last 40, 45 years. So, we all can't be, we can only be in one place at a time. So I know that there will be something if I'm healthy enough and my health continues and my mental clarity continues. I'm going to do this for as long as they'll allow me. And when they don't allow me to do it anymore, I will be teaching it, coaching it, and directing it, because I'd love to pass on my craft, what I've learned, to help other people maximize their ability and find their bliss and pursue their path. So even if they never hire me a day again after Pay the Writer, I'll be okay, because I love this and I'm going to do it in some capacity and they can't stop me. If something good comes along that meets the criteria that we talked about earlier, I'll be right there for it. I like the classics, as you know, and I still, I still think I have the strength to try King Lear. Wendell Pierce asked me several birthdays ago, maybe 7 years ago, ran into him on the street, and he said, "Ron, when are you going to give your Lear? That's what I want to know, Canada. When are you going to give your Lear? When are you going to give your Lear, Wendell?" Wendell just took a great pass at Willie Loman.
Yeah, he was great.
Yes, was great. Wendell is tremendous artist. And also some producer. You were talking earlier about producers. So, if those opportunities to take those things on come, I will meet them. But guys like me, I've been a character guy for 47 years. And if I can assist in the storytelling, I often say, for character actors like myself, the stars are the jewels and we are the setting for the jewels. Mm-hmm. And I stand ever ready to be the setting for today's jewel,
Okay. And one last question.
Yes.
What would you like the audience to take away from witnessing pay the writer?
Couple of things, Marcia. One, having lived my life as deeply private as I am, but my whole life has been in public and in front of a lens in one way or the other. This is my 52nd or 53rd year in front of the lens. That's how I've made my daily bread as a public person. I hope people get a feel for, because there's so much attention to celebrity and being known and fame, that there's a price to be paid for that. Personally, there always is a price. Every person of that people, I hate the word celebrity, every well-known or face on your TV or movie screen, even politics, even, there's a personal price to be paid. I hope that people get this, portrays it and makes people think about that a little bit as they go on through their lives and they see the next sensation or someone that they've admired for many, many years, writer, musician, actor, director, whatever, that there's a price that they pay. I hope they get that. And boy, I just had a thought about a great director, film director, that I had to work with that passed away today, William Friedkin. Billy, it just hit me. May he rest in peace. I learned a lot from him. That was a joy to work with him, a privilege. I also, more important than the fame aspect, I've always liked projects, pieces of dramatic art that have the possibility, that focus on the possibility of redemptive love. I don't know that there are any cure-alls or panaceas in the world. And, my life has made me pretty skeptical of a lot of things. But I do believe that if there is any redemptive medicine in human life, it is love. And that love has the possibility of repair and growth as long as we have breath. The possibility is there. And it's only reachable to me through love. And I think that's at the bottom of Tawney's plays, as all the best plays are in some dimension or another. Whether they be comedy or drama, whether they be classical or modern, the best plays are always not just about relationships. All plays are about relationships. The best plays are about love, and more importantly, love's redemptive possibilities.
This has been Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Marcia Pendleton. Have a good one.
WBAI is holding an election to seat listener members like yourself on the local station board. In an effort to make this election financially and environmentally sustainable, we will use primarily electronic ballots. If you are eligible to vote in this election and we do not have your email on file or your email has bounced, you may receive a text message or phone call from election staff with instructions on how to provide us your current email address. E-ballots will hit your inbox on August 15th, and you will have until September 30th to cast your vote. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information or leave a voicemail on 213-635-9363.
The Outreach and Fundraising Task Force meets Monday, August 14th at 7 p.m. We'll hear from the New York Immigration Coalition about the needs of new migrants and about how WBAI can better serve you. That's Monday, August 14th at 7 p.m. on Zoom. Call 646-558-8656, 646-558-8656, with meeting ID WBAILSB995 or 922-457-2995. The passcode is 995-9999. 995-9999, or go to the meeting section of wbai.org. That's the meeting section of WBAI.org.